give somebody else a call. We'll do the same. We'll take a roll. I'm Carl Boyce. I'm calling from San Francisco.
I'm Brandon Wallace, calling from Prattville, Alabama.
Mark Solomon, calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Pat Fry, calling from New York, and I'm going to go on mute. Anna Tucker from Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky.
Harry Targ, Indiana.
Walter Teague from Maryland.
Jim Campbell, South Carolina.
Marilyn Albert and my sister Janice in Cleveland, Ohio.
Mary Eleazar, Berkeley, California.
Zach Robinson, Greenville, North Carolina.
That it? Okay. So we'll get started. This is a discussion of Donnie Jacob's Ladder, and this is our final session. And today we're going to hear reflections for today from and about Jack O'Dell's book.
Tina has joined the conference.
Well, Jim Skillman
has joined the conference.
Okay, so what we're going to do is Brandon's going to lead off, and after Brandon finishes, if there are any questions directed at him, not comments, but questions, we'll spend some time taking questions, and following that, Mark will speak. And when Mark is finished, then we will have general discussion with a session lasting for about an hour and a half. Is that acceptable to everyone?
Yep. Yep.
Brandon, you're on.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm going to lead off talking about contemporary reflections for Jack O'Dell's book. And I've jotted down some notes, so I'm going to basically be reading from my notes and discussion. And I had some ideas, so I'm going to be talking about that here and just my reflections on what was written there. So contemporary reflections. Starting off talking about the Democracy Charter. One of the main things that CCDS is has taken up now is the Democracy Charter. Hello. And Jack O'Dell has proposed the Democracy Charter as a means for progressive movement towards economic and social justice as a sort of a guide for people in this country and really around the world. As a guide for progressive movement. And he goes through and he discusses each point looking at economic and social issues that can be addressed and directed from the Democracy Charter. Now, what I have written down in my notes and what I would like to discuss, it goes back a little bit before discussion of the Democracy Charter, but thinking about the Democracy Charter, he addresses the Bandung Conference, and I sort of started thinking, and my brain started working a little bit. And in thinking about how we can use the Democracy Charter, how we can use the Democracy Charter and Jack O'Dell's insight for our own progressive movement. one of the things he talked about was the Bandung Conference, and the whole idea and legacy of the Bandung Conference. The Bandung Conference was where, the, I don't want to use the term third world, but the nations of the world that were in Southeast Asia, of Africa, and the poorer and people of color and other minority countries in the world got together to hash out their plan for liberation struggle. Now, that made me think of the whole discussion of the Bandung Conference put into my mind, because there have been three people really that I have paid attention to in terms of the discussion of the Bandung Conference, and Jack O'Dell has his discussion here. But then also I have heard, read W.B. Du Bois speaking of the Bandung Conference, but also Malcolm X. So my thoughts started floating around the Democracy Charter and how that discussion of the Bandung Conference and how we in contemporary movement might move forward with this sort of thing. So what I thought about was Malcolm X looked at the Bandung Conference, and this is in some of his writings and in his autobiography, and he devised a plan. Well, firstly, he wanted to take the United States before the United Nations to have the U.S. Charged for crimes against humanity for their treatment of blacks and other minorities in the country. So this also made me think about, let me go through my other point and then I'll come back. And then this also made me think about, my thought pattern went this way. He wanted to take the United States for the UN. And the UN is a very useful tool it can be for progressive movement. What it also made me think of, and just follow the way I'm thinking, is there's a lady named Betty Reardon, and she has something called the Anti-Patriarchy Project, which is also housed in the UN. And what the Anti-Patriarchy Project has done is they have outlined several devised a plan, a statement of purpose, if you will, of how to desensitize, to sensitize communities to patriarchal structures within various communities in the U.S. and around the globe. So this made me start thinking about what direction the Democracy Charter could take. And again, the Democracy Charter is a charter, which is the word I sort of focused on and thinking about. So far, we have been discussing the Democracy Charter as sort of an abstract thing and been thinking about, having discussions around the Democracy Charter and ways in which to, bring the Democracy Charter to the wider masses, I guess, in terms of how we might use that. So what I have thought of is that especially in my workings around the Democracy Charter, one of the many things that people have asked me is, what concretely can we do or do you want done around the Democracy Charter? So I'm thinking the Democracy Charter is a document, and it's not a legal document, but it's a public document. So my thoughts are, and what I jotted down, the Democracy Charter could be a tool that various groups that are formed either through CCDS or whatever might take before city council, state legislature, and various other community boards, if you will, but mainly city councils, state legislatures, people that can adopt these sort of things, to have the democracy charter adopted as a plan of action. We have seen things like this done with, you know, various cities adopting anti-war plaques, you know, stating their opposition to war, or in terms of immigration, where they have declared certain cities safe havens for immigrants, or, you know, declared their opposition to immigration policies. And I think that the Democracy Charter could be used in such a way that, you know, we could take this outline that Jack O'Dell has proposed in terms of the economic and social demands that are outlined here and that are to be addressed, and take them before community boards or community or city councils or state legislatures to have them, you know, adopted as a sort of a creed, and I think that might be a very interesting way to proceed with the Democracy Charter in a very tangible and concrete way, because I think that, you know, in this current climate of in this economic recession that we're in, and the collapse of the social, economic, and physical infrastructures in this country, I don't see why this couldn't be feasible, that the Democracy Charter could be used, I mean, as sort of a, I mean, take it to a city council, then, you know, have them adopt this as sort of their statement of their statement of purpose, or their statement of values, I guess. But I think that would be a very interesting way to take this Democracy Charter. And again, I sort of thought about that, thinking about the different ways that other documents, such as Betty Reardon's Anti-Patriarchy Project or Malcolm X's project, have been used in terms of, you know, taking it before something that is official, that or if not even, you know, something that has some kind of, I don't want to use the word merit, but that could enact, make some kind of enactment on this charter, because this is a charter, and charters can be adopted. And so that's what I proposed in looking at the discussion on the contemporary reflection in O'Dell's book, and thinking about our purpose with the Democracy Charter. Those were my notes that I jotted down, and I have an outline that is related, but I was going to save that for the social forum. So that's my presentation as of what I have now.
Okay, thank you, Brandon. Any questions for Brandon? Okay, Mark.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. I just wanted to ask Brandon, I think this is excellent thinking. I really thank you for presenting these ideas. I mean, I really think that this is a direction we can absolutely go in. I was wondering if you could draw out just a little bit more about how the Bandung Conference spurred your thinking on this. I'm not sure exactly, but I would be interested to know and also the connection to Malcolm X and how you're thinking on that too.
How that goes there? Yeah. Well, the Bandung conference is a fascinating thing to me because, and the way I sort of progress my thoughts along that line, the Bandung conference was the conference where these various people met from various third world countries. I don't have another term that I can use at the moment for that, but where they met and they devised a plan. And really, the Bandung conference has always been sort of this awesome thing to me because, you know, they all left the Bandung conference and went back to Africa and went back to Southeast Asia and went back to the United States and started these liberation struggles, which overthrew colonialism in a large way. And it all came out of that meeting. I first started thinking about the Bandung conference, became really aware of the Bandung Conference and thought about it in any way from reading Malcolm X and his discussion of the Bandung Conference. And he had some very interesting things to say. Now, in terms of Malcolm X and his and how I tied Malcolm X into that, right before he was assassinated, but also I think it was something that he built into the OAAU, the Organization of African American Unity, and I had actually I had thought about this and had some discussion with some people back when I was in my undergraduate, but he had proposed, and this was in the early 60s, right, I think it was before the Civil Rights Act had passed, but he argued that, you know, if they could take, you know, South Africa before the UN for its treatment of an apartheid, if they could take and I forget what all countries he used as examples, but they were taking these countries before the UN to be reprimanded basically for their treatment of minority populations within their borders. And he was arguing if these countries can do this and, you know, use the UN as a body through which to browbeat, if nothing else, you know, the countries that they were targeting, then why not, you know, take the United States before the UN have them charged with crimes against humanity for, you know, the violence that happened throughout the 50s and the early 60s in the civil rights struggle and before that, and basically for its own apartheid system. And this was something that I don't remember who I emailed, but I emailed somebody a long time ago, like 2000. And I was like, you know, Malcolm X had devised this plan to, you know, take the United States before the UN, and, you know, he was assassinated, but I was just wondering why nobody had ever picked that up and run with it, you know. It was, I've always been interested in, you know, why, you know, the what, why, and how, and, you know, what would have come of that, because I thought that would have been an effective and concrete thing to do in terms of you know, making the point that this cannot be continued. But then also, I really, a few days ago, in looking at the reflections part, you know, I it just struck me that, you know, the word charter is in the name of this document. And a charter, and this was just my thinking, you know, charter is like one of the oldest civil things in Western society. everything has a charter, you know, and business and capitalism and government. So this is a charter, and it could be used as a charter to be taken before whatever body and, you know, have them evaluate it. And I think that that would be, you know, something tangible and concrete. But that's my thinking. That was what I was thinking at the time.
Very good. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mark? Okay. Before I begin, I hope you'll indulge me for a second on an organizational point, which is actually very fundamentally involved in our discussion today. We have a democracy charter, picking up from Brandon, we have a democracy charter workshop, as some of you know, at the social forum on Friday, June 25th from 1 to 3 p.m., the democracy charter, an organizing force for research and progressive movement with Phil Fletcher and Francis Fox Piven and Carl Davidson and Tim Johnson. Jackie Camasso.
The conference.
Tuesday morning we'll have 1,500 leaflets at the CCBS table correct me if I'm wrong, the Solidarity Economy tent. And those of you who are attending the social forum, I hope you'll just stop off earlier rather than later at the table, pick up some leaflets and help distribute them. That would be enormously helpful in building the charter and, of course, building successful attendance at the workshop. So that's the end of my plug. Now on to the Jack's book itself. I think, first of all, the book is so rich in content, you know, reflecting upon its fundamental meaning. I went back and looked over what I had put in yellow marker and discovered that damn near 60% of the book was in yellow marker. It's a kind of a book that we should pick up periodically and section by section read again and try to digest the meaning of what Jack is saying. I think that Jack O'Dell's life itself is a model of historic clarity, both on the nature of oppression and on the nature of struggle. At the core, and in thinking about this, at the core of the book is really the core of Jack's life, which is centered on the building of mass movements, that there were never any narrow, cramped, sectarian concerns in Jack's thinking. Always looking toward what he calls the dual authority of mass movements contesting official authority, of building mass struggle from the grassroots. That was the key to his life as a merchant seaman, as a political organizer, as a worker intellectual, and may I throw in a little controversial point here, the clarity and depth of Jack's thinking is so sharp in comparison to this long, overblown introduction, which has many good points in it, but is so heavily freighted with academic husk that the meaning of what Jack had to say itself sometimes gets obscured. So I think that, in a sense, validates validates Jack's tremendous intellect as a worker intellectual, as a labor activist, as a central force in the Southern Christian Leadership Council to the Rainbow Coalition and to the Democracy Charter today, in which Jack remains very active, very involved. Jack is always seeking to build that mass movement which constitutes, in his words, the dual authority against established authority. He's always looking at the so-called limits of a particular movement in terms of how it's part of a historic continuum that leads to a much broader and deeper struggle for social transformation. And, you know, with that in mind, I think those are essential elements of what Climbing Jacob Ladder is about. It's really about the very nature of power in American society. It's very much about the centrality, and we can't emphasize this too sharply, the centrality of racism in consolidating that power and that kind of sway over the entire society, and the centrality of the importance of the struggle against racism and all its manifestations. Some of the key elements, I think, of climbing Jacob's ladder, and it by no means exhaust the list that is so incredibly rich in content. First of all, Jack is always sensitive to, and something that we can't lose sight of today, is the inseparable and essential link between racism and empire. From the Mexican War to Vietnam to Afghanistan, racism is a driving factor, not only in pursuing these wars, but in clamping upon the domestic society certain constraints economically, socially, politically, ideologically, that limit the society and kind of attempt to crush dissent and opposition to war. The militarized society and the national security state, and Jack's view is built on racism and on the crushing of social needs. And as part of that, and we see that, you know, thinking about what's going on today, it's so obvious in terms of the right-wing counteroffensive against the Obama administration and against progressive policies, that white supremacy and anti-communism, which have always been deeply linked, are inseparably linked today. And so that the struggle against white supremacy invariably has to involve a struggle against war, racism, and anti-communism. Next, another major aspect, I think, that is central to climbing Jacob's ladder is the labor and African-American freedom movements that joined at the hip. Labor becomes, and this is very very clear in the chapter on the nurses' strike in South Carolina and its implications for the labor movement throughout the South and throughout the country, that the struggle for labor's gains cuts to the very heart of the struggle against the institutional oppression of racism. That the battle for economic advance becomes a battle that is a kind of embryonic struggle for social transformation, which is essentially the role of the labor movement. Labor movement in fighting for the advance of particularly unskilled, semi-skilled workers in the most oppressed categories provides the basis for a much broader struggle to deeply transform power relations in American society. On the other hand, the freedom movement is essential to building the labor movement as a social movement, as a movement that recognizes that the fate of the working class is not only tied to economic questions, but tied to the broader realm of political and social empowerment. And that was one of the major contributions of what Jack refers to as the freedom movement, a very carefully chosen term, I think, which embraces the concept of a civil rights movement, but goes beyond the civil rights movement, and that it's not simply a struggle against formal segregation and formal constraints on equality, but a struggle for a deeper social transformation. I think it's very important, really, and I know I listened in on some of the discussion last week, so I won't really try to repeat any of it. I think Jack's grasp of history, of the historical continuum, and of the contradictions inherent in American history is so vital to an understanding of his outlook and of where we're heading. The formation of what he calls a racial state was built upon slavery, which in turn was a crucial aspect of the development of capitalism. While institutionally separate from the larger capitalist system, it nevertheless was part of that system, was an aspect of that system, and was central to capital accumulation. And it was the template for the destruction of Native American societies, for the Mexican War, and for the emergence of doctrines that justified racial oppression, such as, and Jack emphasizes this, the Teutonic Origins Doctrine, which affected not only African Americans, but was a doctrine that kind of abetted the oppression of other groups of Latinos, Asians, and others. Another major point, I think, in Jack's book and in his thinking, is the global reach of racism. And the fact that you cannot separate racism as a simply domestic phenomenon, as again as a driving force for empire, and again it kind of harkens back not only to the international dimensions of racism, but also to the way racism affects the domestic population in constraining its ability to advance politically, in commanding loyalty and crushing dissent, and limiting the possibilities of economic advancement for the most oppressed segments of society in the first place. Going back to Jack's historical analysis, racism explodes, and I guess Jack constantly emphasizes this, the dominant myth that the nation was born in democracy, and that I think is very much the heart of his thinking, that if you go back and look at the so-called founding fathers, essentially rich white men, who attempted to countenance and somehow accommodate slavery and temporize with slavery. But beyond that also, the 10th Federalist Paper, for example, not only talks about the diffusion of power, but it talks about the diffusion of power in a way in which the masses of people, faction as they call it, can never become a dominant factor in American life. So that the constraints on democracy were characteristic of the founding of the country, and at the heart of that was the question of racial oppression, which was manifested in slavery. Jack characterizes the situation confronting African Americans as being colonized, not as part of a colonial system per se, but rather colonized in terms of the denial of land, of political disfranchisement, and of having economic underdevelopment foisted upon them. And that becomes one of the central features of the development of capitalism in the United States. And Jack O'Dell makes this cryptic but kind of cutting comment, which comes to the very core of a certain kind of enlightenment that one finds in the African-American experience, when he says, "It may be that we who stand in the lineage of people who were sold in the marketplace have something to say about the limits of market freedom." Because Jack constantly comes back to the point that the revolution left black people enslaved and thus colonized. And thus we find, as part of that colonized status, the compulsion toward resistance and toward fighting to build what he calls a dual authority, and linking with other forces who are oppressed to challenge the dominant system and to try to press against that system to extract concessions and to build to a deeper social transformation. And in response to that, he argues, and this is a very profound point that I think is very relevant at this political moment, that what has been foisted upon African Americans historically and contemporarily is war, is a kind of war against them, aimed toward ghettoizing, subjugating, and thwarting the effort to build resistance. And that has dynamic, I think, contemporary relevance today, especially the election of Obama, which in many ways was a transforming step in the consciousness, particularly in part of the younger generation, and cannot be underestimated. Yet at the same point, at the same time, in terms of the institutional tenacity and even deepening of racist oppression in the midst of economic crisis, as at a point where, when we constantly make note of the fact that there are more African American youths in prisons than in colleges and universities, when we take note of the fact that the war on on drugs initiated in the Reagan administration has, in for all intents and purposes, become a war against African Americans, especially African American youth, you have a deeper understanding, I think, of what Jack is saying, something that perhaps the progressive movement today has lost, I think, to some extent, in its understanding of the social dynamics in American society. Jack goes on to talk about black power. And Jack's own conception of black power is rooted in a tremendous concreteness in terms of regional, local, and area circumstances. That black power is the winning of authority, of abutting and overcoming elements of that official authority that is oppressive and racist. It means political power. It means the ability of black people to control critical aspects of their lives, like their economic development, their cultural possibilities, their educational attainment, and housing and health care, etc. And that, of course, impinges upon the dynamics of the entire society, advancing the entire society. His criticism of the black power slogan as it emerged in the late 1960s was precisely that, that it was a slogan without a program. And he argued that without a program, even though the slogan was dynamic and imaginative in many ways, it was not productive because it was not kind of deepened and embedded in a program. Another major aspect is something I think that we really have to think a lot more about. It's Jack's insistence on the centrality of internationalism and the struggle for racial and social and class justice in the United States. That the global and domestic struggles for peace and freedom are inseparably interrelated. That the struggle for peace, and I think this is something that those of us who work in a peace movement have to continually come back to and battle for, is a struggle against racism. It's a struggle for economic survival and for progress. And Jack insists, especially thinking after the assassination of Dr. King, which he said from the standpoint of the ruling class had a certain kind of imminence about it, that King moved clearly from a Christian idealist to a Christian revolutionary, that he saw that the struggle for civil rights was being transformed into a freedom movement, required a struggle for peace, required a struggle against the massive expenditure of funds in imperial adventures, that required a rejection of anti-communism, a rejection of all kinds of forms of racism and jingoism as vital to moving the progressive movement forward. Another aspect which I think is really important to think about is Jack O'Dell's approach to the Jesse Jackson campaigns in 1984 and 88, the Operation Push, and ultimately to the Rainbow Coalition. Jack argues that these are independent mass movements, independent movements, movements, again, of the dual authority of masses of people struggling the entrenched official authority of government and those at the economic and political heights of American society. That the fact that in 1984 and 88 they chose to manifest and to try to move forward this independent movement within the Democratic Party was far less important than the very nature of its independence. And the assumption that runs through the thinking in this book is that one develops political struggles where the masses exist and where the masses are struggling. One relates to that struggle, tries to give it leadership, tries to tap in and understand the compulsions that are driving masses, both in terms of the organizations they choose to utilize in their battles, but also in terms of the ideology they wish to advance. At some point, it may be necessary to build an independent party, build an independent political movement. In fact, I think the implication is that ultimately it probably will have to come to that. But what is essential at this point is that there's no quibbling, there's no quarreling in these kind of narrow cramped, constrained quarters about questions of tactics. The fundamental question is nourishing and building what he calls that dual authority of masses of people. From that standpoint, and I won't go over what Harry talked about last week, Paul Robeson becomes symbolic of what now historians finally recognize as the long civil rights movement of struggles that emerged in the 20s and 30s and continued through the wartime years into the post-war years, struggles for fair housing, struggles for jobs, struggles for economic advancement, struggles for peace, and ultimately struggles for the preservation of the New Deal. And this was perhaps Robeson's leadership in this area was symbolic of the continuity of that struggle, along with the boys who gave deep intellectual content to it and deeper understanding of its historic framework. The freedom movement then becomes a clarion voice of the people searching for deeper social transformation. Always throughout the book, civil rights was a bridge to a deeper and more transforming freedom movement. Jack concludes, and I quote, "Alice has never been a struggle of black against white. It is the struggle of the unrepresented against an oligarchy of despotism which has clothed itself in hypocrisy and deceit. That's the long civil rights movement. That's the movement which in many respects is a template for the establishment of dual authority and is a model for the women's movements, for the gay and lesbian movements, for the Latino movements, for the Asian movements, for movements that are emerging today. The Democracy Charter, I think, we can understand better as the embodiment of that mass dual authority as an effort to give greater life, greater coherence, and greater sustenance to that dual authority. That it projects the concept of unity across many, many different boundaries, boundaries of race, boundaries of social condition. It is most important an answer, a clarion answer to the right-wing attempt to usurp and co-opt the growing outrage against big corporate domination. It's a rallying point for mass struggle, and I think it's in itself an appropriate and inspiring way for this particular volume to end, and I don't think I've done it any kind of degree of justice that it deserves, and I hope we'll continue to read it and study it and discuss it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. We're now going to open up for comments. If you have any questions, you can direct them at Mark about his presentation, but we're also having comments. Please try and, be concise so that everybody gets a chance to talk. Okay, and if you want to talk, just as soon as there's a moment of silence and nothing's happening, then just speak up. Okay? Who wants to go first?
Well, this is Harry. The presentation's been wonderful. Reading the book has been wonderful. And I feel personally sad that I didn't read it in the 60s, read the Essays in Freedom Ways. And my emerging politicization in the 60s, I think, led me to develop a kind of hegemonic view of the forces of domination and oppression, and being attracted to writers, theorists like Herbert Marcuse talked about one-dimensional man. And I think what Odell's theoretical perspective suggests is the dialectical character of human experience. And by using the Bandung Conference, the Freedom Charter, and a whole variety of meetings of representatives of countries of the Global South, and even some of their activities within the United Nations General Assembly, suggest a variety of ways in which nations and people resisted empire and imperialism. There's a couple of books I've looked at recently that I just want to, throw out their names that sort of add to, no way of the quality of Jack's work, but add to this analysis. Vijaya Prashad wrote a book called The Darker Nations, and it's a people's history of the third world, he calls it. And it's a history of not only Bandung, but a series of other meetings that occurred from the 50s, really, through the 1980s, of representatives of countries and peoples of the global south. And I read one by an academic that's apologized for that. Penny von Eschen wrote a book called Race and Empire, Black Americans and Anti-Colonialism, 1937 to 1957. And in this book, she documents that there was in existence in this historical period over 200 African-American newspapers, press service that received regular analyses from the Council on African Affairs, and she argues that the African American community was very much in tune with the anti-colonial struggles that were going on around the world, whereas many, if not most other Americans, were sort of blinded to what was going on. The last thing I'd mention is that this kind of dialectical view of global struggles continues to be manifest in the continued existence of the non-aligned movement and the organization of Bolivarian states, the movements that are emerging in Latin America, and a whole variety of exciting formations that are challenging Western imperialism and empire, so that this sort of simplistic view that I started politically with of a world of hegemony and the dominated global capital was naive then as it is now. And maybe we could say in its own modest way, the U.S. social forum, which is a descendant of the world social forum movement, is another manifestation of this kind of dialectical view that Jack O'Dell, you know, clearly wrote about in the 1950s and 1960s. Thank you.
Thank you, Perry. Who wants to go next?
This is Zach. I wanted to thank the presenters for a very nice presentation.
Pat.
Especially, I
has enjoyed left the conference.
Pat
has joined the conference.
I thought Mark's presentation was really dynamic and caught a lot of the, you know, caught some ideas that really that are in O'Dell's book that I've been trying to understand. I think in particular his explanation of the, you know, how O'Dell sees the role of the Democracy Charter is very, very important for us to grasp, in that it relates several things, but this concept of the dual authority of mass movements is really, it's central in what O'Dell, in his work around the Rainbow Coalition, as Mark said, and ties together this, you know, some of the strategic or tactical orientation that emerged in Montgomery, where there was both joining of the struggle within the institutions of the state, in other words, the court battle in the case of Montgomery, with the mass action and the establishment of a dual authority in the mass movement. In the Montgomery Improvement Association, they established their own transit authority and their own, you know, transit system in order to make a change in the transit system for the whole city. And that theme, of course, runs through as well in Jack's work with the Rainbow Coalition. Even in dealing with the question of internationalism, which somehow seems like the most thing that's the most inaccessible to a grassroots movement, how do you deal with establishing dual authority in the sphere of international relations. And I mean, there are traditional protests against war, but I think that the Rainbow Coalition also took that to another level in terms of it's the conduct of an independent diplomacy. When Jackson went to the Middle East, he visited, he met with Arafat, breaking through this wall separating, you know, that the United States and its allies had put around meeting with the Palestinian leadership, and it created a tremendous breakthrough, and it points to the real power of this idea of dual authority. I think also Mark's placing of the Democracy Charter as a generalization of the idea of the Black Freedom Movement to everybody. I think that's also a really, you know, an important thing to put forward. So I was just grooving on what you had to say, Mark.
This is Pat. I'm going to jump in here. I want to echo what Jack just said, and thank Mark and Brandon both for these presentations today, and all of them have been really rich. I am thinking of I don't know if any of you have seen the budding program that's being put forward today around a major march in Washington on October 2nd. And the list of demands, the programmatic demands that are being put forward, it's not final yet, and I think there's discussions going on around the country right now, spearheaded by the labor movement and the NAACP and the National Council of La Raza. And it's just so glaring, the big omission in, you know, the different pieces that are being put forward as program. You know, jobs, of course, is front and center, immigration reform, but the big missing piece is the military-industrial complex and the defense spending, and no mention of foreign policy at all. And, you know, this, of course, has always been a huge problem. But the way the Democracy Charter places this issue is just so central to the entire agenda. And all of Jack's writings and his huge contribution to put that issue as integral to the advancement of the progressive agenda, I think is really important and key today, as much as it has ever been. And so I think, you know, that's the Democracy Charter can play a role in advancing that understanding, I think. And it's going to have to evolve itself in a grassroots way, I think, having meetings with unions, grassroots organizations, city councils, as Brandon has said. But I think that's the way this tool can be used, I think, to advance that. That's what I have to say.
Could I jump in for a second on that point? We have in the Boston area something called the Majority Agenda Project, which some of you may be familiar with, which attempts really to bring about a convergence of movements around the economic crisis and subsumed under that the healthcare crisis and crisis of education, housing, etc., the environmental crisis and the crisis of the empire and wars. And a couple of our full-time organizers actually have been, and this is important, I've been meeting with Bill Lynch, who's a long-time political activist in Harlem and someone who has always helped organize campaigns for progressive African-American candidates. And they talked about incorporating the peace issue in various forms, particularly in terms of the negative effects militarized economy and military spending into the program of the march on October 2nd. And even though it's not reflected in the initial program, there have been very positive responses to that from District 1199, which is a big fat force in this. There was a meeting in Washington in which we deliberately corralled Leslie Kagan and Medea Benjamin and other leading forces in the peace movement to attend. Leslie talked about the inclusion of the peace issue, got a terrific ovation. But, you know, there's a certain kind of resistance that is complicated, which I don't think we can go into now. But these local meetings, I think if people could hook up with these local meetings and organizing around October 2nd and continuing to press the peace issue as an essential and necessary aspect of a real program to deal with the effects of the crisis, both of the economy and the environment, I think we can make some real headway. I don't think the issue, and I think Pat's quite right, that this is not the final point, and the issue is still not settled. So I think we could continue to press on this.
Very good. Maybe this is Norma. Maybe somebody can talk to me or us about that. My reaction to the call for peace without the substantive calls relative to the cause of war. You know, it's very nice to call for peace, but how do you get that in a world where war, you know, Keynesian economics, military Keynesianism is the basis of how we function, without talking about how people get along because of the wars, and it's been this way for how long, you know?
This is Randy. Can I speak now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about this concept of the dual authority, the mass movement, and Mark, you know, characterizes it as anti-government, which I think at the time was right on the mark. I think that the concept of progressive majority that the CCDS has put forward represents the dual authority today, and I think that the Obama administration, you know, is a manifestation of the strength of the progressive majority and that dual authority. And I think that the struggle within the government over which authority, you know, is going to come out on top, the authority of capital or the progressive majority, is an interesting phenomenon going on right now. And I think another way to look at government as somewhat a representative of the dual authority of the people is it's become clear in the mining disaster in West Virginia, the Gulf of Mexico cataclysm, that the regulatory power of government is a representative of the dual authority of the people versus rampant capitalism. The last point I want to make is on the international level, although the UN has really lost a lot of the effectiveness that we've seen years earlier, I think it's still important to look at the United Nations as a source of expression of dual authority. The United Nations adopted a Millennium Development Goal, which the United States signed, pledging full employment. And the ILO is doing a lot of work around full employment. And in February of this year, they issued a statement saying, quote, "We need the same policy decisiveness that saved banks now applied to save and create jobs and livelihoods of people. This can be done through strong convergence of public policies and private investment." And I think that relates to a lot of the discussion that's going on over the issue of the deficit, you know, whether people's programs are going to be funded or, you know, whether taking all the money. So I think that the concept of due authority has progressed, and I think it's being expressed today a lot more in the electoral arena. Thanks.
Can I ask a question behind what was just said, which I think had nothing to do with what I was asking before, and that is, how does the Obama administration in any way, besides that he's black, represent things that we're about? Anybody going to jump in on that? If not, I will. Okay, well, let me just put it real concretely. The Obama administration, over the protests of the Republicans, just constituted a pro-labor National Labor Relations Board, which just ruled in favor of an organizing campaign that I was a part of for a long time. I mean, that's one concrete example of what we won in November 08. And, you know, I think that there's many other examples, and it is hugely contradictory. I think, you know, the corporate Wall Street, pharmaceutical, banking interests, and the military interests are hugely dominant in this society and control most of Congress. I think that's what the Obama administration is up against. And I think the State Department, led by Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, is controlling the foreign policy agenda, which is essentially the same as the Bush administration. Absolutely. That's the challenge before us. And I don't think it does any good to talk about what is there any difference between the Obama administration and the Bush administration? I think absolutely there is. We have a lot more breathing room. The progressive movement has been on the offensive for the first time in decades, really. It was not on the offensive in the same way under the Clinton administration. And I others might want to disagree or add to that, but I just think that it's just a disservice to our movement to not see what the differences are between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. I think that, you know, well, I'll stop there.
Well, I want to comment here. I think this is sort of related to the question we're discussing in terms of climbing Jacob's ladder and the charter. I don't think there's any question about, you know, the Obama administration is the same as the Bush administration. I don't even entertain that notion. But I'd like to approach it from a different angle, and I think what conclusions we come to about the state of things today and the balance of political forces in this country should determine what we do. That is, what in response do we as conscious actors or aspiring to be conscious actors on the stage of history, how do we respond? I think that's the essence of Jack's message, and it has to be repeated over and over again. So that while we can maintain amongst ourselves differences over our estimate of where Obama's head is, or even where administration policies are, nonetheless, the question revolves around where do we have leverage? Where can we do anything about it? And I think that some of that has been sketched out here today. For instance, on the question of the demonstration, the national demonstration on October 2nd, I don't I agree. I'm very pleased to hear Mark's report about what happened in the meeting in D.C. But I think it has to go one step further. I think that the important thing in terms of raising the question of foreign policy and international affairs in the context of this demonstration has to become the cause of the left, and that we have to find the ways both organizationally to get the message out, but also to make it public. It would be really a good thing if someone were to write something that could be distributed around on the, you know, various means, giving people a clue, giving people a sort of a handle with which to tie this question together. I see it happening all the time around here. I go to meetings, senior meetings, community meetings, meetings against cutbacks, meetings against school closures and that kind of thing. And what happens is invariably someone, usually one of our members, will get up and say, hey, let's talk about the military budget. And if we don't talk about the military budget, we're falling far short. I think there has to be sort of a cause of ours that we implement, and in that way sort of tie the issues together, not just because their issues are tied together, but because it's a linchpin and consistent with the way Jack laid it out.
Randy, I just want to really endorse what you said, Carl, and I think that also that, you know, that we should tie in the United Nations Millennium Development Goals to our international activities in terms of global war, and, you know, call for us, our government, to own up to, you know, to performing its duties as a signatory to the Millennium Development Goals. We have 5 years to go. And there's such a contrast in what we're actually doing and the way we're spending money to our commitments under those goals. And I think those goals really connect to our domestic agenda of full employment and education, health care. Thanks.
Anyone else?
Well, I just want to know one more thing, Norma here, and that is,
has joined the conference.
Do we, complain about whatever we do, look at the Obama administration and all the things that he's not taking the initiative where Bush had no qualms about going ahead and making rules regardless of law. Obama, when we criticize what Obama does or doesn't do, are we part of the, I forget how it was described, but a racist kind of behavior, we on the left, that is, I do Peace and Freedom Party, in case you don't know, the Socialist Party here in California. And I just wonder if we fall into that heading of being of talking about the Obama administration because we're racist.
Well, absolutely not.
I mean,
if you have criticism of Obama and the policies that he's pursued, it should make them. I was just on the radio the other day blasting Obama for his response to the oil spill. I think much more is called for, and I think he's taking the wrong position. And I think when that happens, we should say so.
What did you think he should do?
Take over BP, run the show.
Okay, thanks.
Let me say something else. I really do. I mean, when I say that we, meaning the left, I mean the whole left. I mean, it's the Green Party and the Peace and Freedom Party and other left formations should be in the forefront of raising and responding to the critical issues facing the people today and in line with the mass movement that's growing. And unfortunately, I don't see that.
Well, because green is not left, green is almost center, it's capitalist, you know.
We can argue about that.
No, oh, it is. It advocates for entrepreneurs.
Can I jump in on this? Because I think that there are some important initiatives that are just beginning to get underway. You know, USPJ, the peace movement, has been discussing this. I was just in a meeting this last week, a strategy meeting with community organizations and peace organizations, but the emphasis was on community organizations that are, you know, working day to day on issues. And Mike Prokosh from Boston came to talk about some of the work going on in Boston, where community organizations that are involved in fighting against home foreclosures are beginning to raise the issue of the military budget. And that's the direction we need to go in, that the organizations that are dealing with joblessness, homelessness, the job question have to be in the forefront of raising this question of where is our money going? It's going to the military, and it's got to be redirected back home. And I think
Jim Skillman,
you know,
has left the conference.
This is the direction that we have to go in, and it's not going to come out of the peace movement necessarily. It's going to come out of making the connections and moving with, you know, grassroots organizations to move that issue.
Let me piggyback on that, what Pat is saying, and her earlier comments in terms of the organizers, Jim Campbell in South Carolina. I want to thank Brandon and Mark for a tremendous contribution. A question, Mark, is are your notes available for publication? Because your paper and your report unpacked a lot of what's the content in not only the book, but also in the programmatic possibilities of the Democracy Charter.
So, you know, well, as some scattered notes, I guess we could...
That would be extremely helpful, because one of the things that is central to the book is the long continuity of a life involved in struggle.
Right.
And most of us have not had access or a relationship to that life. My situation has been fortunate in having been part of that Freedom Waves family over its lifetime. And I hear the need for having a conversation and an understanding of those articles and the issues that they raise. There are a couple of concepts that you raised and put on the table, I think, that's necessary for us going forward, and that is to understand what the dual authority is of the movement. That doesn't come through government organizations. And that's an important point. The movement was not authorized nor sanctioned by the government. It was a thing that said, we the people shall govern. And that's an important thing, because as that dual authority achieved a certain mass consensus, the government took to itself a pattern of assimilation, particularly among young people at Jackson State, at Kent State, at South Carolina State, and those young people in Chicago in 1968 Democratic Convention. And the thwarting of those young people in the 64 convention in Atlantic City that came in with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And there were masses of young people on the boardwalk that stayed out there overnight waiting to come into that convention to support the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party
coming out of that struggle in Mississippi. That notion of a dual authority is the voice of the people saying that they are the moral authority. That will not come from either city council or county council or any state legislature. And I think that's an important point in organizing and creating an authority for ourselves. Another idea that you raised, I think that we really need to expand and focus upon and discuss and digest and embrace, is the notion of the continuity of America as an empire. Mm-hmm. And an empire that has its basis in private ownership of land and private ownership of African labor. And that the form that has taken over time. So this has been a profoundly rich exchange for us. And I think that your unpacking of these ideas, Mark, and your presentation today has been especially helpful. And I think that the discussion that will go on that has been prepared for that, what is it called, the grassroots organizing or community organizing group of the Democracy Charter?
And Democracy at a Grassroots Organizing Committee.
The Grassroots Organizing Committee, I think that discussion at the forum, the social forum, will further unpack the ideas and the content of both this book and the Democracy Charter. It's a tool that the Democracy Charter, it isn't a finished document that comes in for acceptance as is. I think it comes in for a correspondence. The Democracy Charter is a point of correspondence for the movement in the sense that the committees of correspondence took place in the 18th century that was the preface to the American Revolution. And it's in that sense that I read the Democracy Charter, and I think that we need to begin to look at that in its committees of correspondence role and function for bringing people out of their cul-de-sacs of organizing and organizations today for a mass people's movement that becomes the moral authority of the country. The right wing is doing it with the so-called Tea Party on the basis of reaction and pre-fascism for the country. And what this is raising, and I think what we're raising, is for a we the people shall govern democratic struggle. And bringing all of this together, the foreign policy of the country is a central part of that. And I think the last point that we need to look at, that was raised, is that when Martin in that Riverside Church speech linked the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, he became what Jack calls a Christian revolutionary and joined the discussion that the civil rights movement, none of them at that time, was looking at the peace movement as an ally. But that speech at Riverside is central because it linked the domestic policy with the foreign policy of this country. And that, I think, we need to do in a very sophisticated and seriously mature and muscular fashion. Because the dominant force of the country is ruled now by corporations and by the military. We do not have a representative government that where your vote really determines the direction of national programs. The fact that Barton, is that his name, from Alabama or Texas, could apologize to BP says a lot about where the power is. The power of these, what is called the Seven Sisters, is something that we really need to look into, the seven major oil companies. Anthony Sampson the analysis of that is very important in this regard. But to look at the creation, not of a progressive majority so much as a dual authority, a people's authority, it's beyond progressivism. It's a radical change in looking at and taking on a mature responsibility for another power dimension, saying that we the people shall govern. But this has been a profoundly rich discussion for us, I think, and for the movement. And if we could have your paper, Mark, I think that would unpack a lot of this for us. And we may want to figure out some way to follow this up in terms of the national work that this offers, you know, the national enrichment and the regional enrichment this discussion offers for us as we work in various regions of the country. But thanks again, Mark, and thank you, Brandon.
Don't put that in there. Yeah. Okay. And I just wanted to say a couple things. I want to thank Brandon and Mark for their really insightful comments, and all the discussion here has been very, very good. I have sat here and made a number of notes of things I'd like to say, and I'm not going to say them all because a lot of them have already been touched on. I think we're in a. I really agree with all this that's said, particularly about this around this October 2nd mobilization, and I think it's very, very important. I think we're in a very favorable situation right now, but I think one of the things that I think the civil rights movement points to is that just because we're in a favorable situation doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of work to do. We just recently in the Democracy Charter, the CCDS Democracy Charter Committee did a study of A Stride Toward Freedom. And I think one of the things that I learned from that book and reading Jack O'Dell's writing too is that the need for basic organization in terms to move the struggle forward in Montgomery, that organization came in the form of the churches. But I think one of the things that we really need to do is really think about going out and building organization and taking these ideas out. This is the third and final discussion around this book that we're having here. But I just really hope that we'll continue to discuss this book in various areas. And I wanted to just let everybody know that I know the Southern Regional Committee is talking about having an expanded study of the book in more detail. And I would just like to invite anybody that would like to participate in that could get in touch with me or anybody from the Southern Region.
I need to say one other thing. I just found it. You might have seen it or know it by heart. C.L.R. James quote, "The race question is subsidiary to the class question in politics, and to think of imperialism in terms of race is disastrous, but to neglect the racial factor as merely incidental is an error only less grave than to make it fundamental." The phrasing I find, I cannot summarize it to people. I have to find the exact words because it's so powerful at every word, and I don't want to leave any of that idea out. He doesn't diminish one versus another. He presents it all very, race is very powerful and central, and so is imperialism, and you get that. The other thing I wanted to say while we think about that, if we care to, is that if we don't talk about the socialist alternative in all our work, we do not offer alternatives, and that's one major reason people don't adhere to what we're doing. If they don't have the hope, socialism is a Bible, a passion, that if we talk about
and offer to people. We want the just world. It's not only an inaccessible utopianism. It's a description of how to live and the ways to go and what we are owed because we're here and all the other things that you can find to say that are tremendously glorious to say. And I encourage that that kind of analysis not be left out of anything that we tell with people.
Hello, this is Tina. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I just like to say, I think that the concept of dual authority is really useful. I hadn't read that part of the book yet, and what I've heard in this discussion makes me feel certain I'm going to go back and read it. But when I think about the dual authority, I think of it as the authority of those who own and control like 90% of everything, and the rest of us who need to make a human society that'll work for humans in general. And to me, the government is just another battleground that we have to determine, you know, how much of our resources we want to put into it and how important is it. And that, to me, is a tactical decision. So, for example, I was on the school board, I don't know, like maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and I ran against a Christian coalition majority school board, and I was one of a slate of five that got elected. So when I was on the school board, I was on the battlefield of the government, and with the coalition I was working with, we did manage to affect policy in a pretty big way. So I would really hope that we don't look at the idea of dual authority as sort of a we don't look at the idea of government as like an either or like an ideological position we need to take, but more of like a tactical discussion we need to have. And I think that if we do that, we'll be able to have more unity as an organization. So that's just my 2 cents. Thanks.
This is Walter. I just want to add a thought and appreciation of everyone's efforts, of course. I think this has been very powerful, helpful. I think as we go forward, especially maybe at the social forum, we ought to keep in mind, I think building on what Tina just said, in our work, we do have to have a dual approach to people that we're organizing directly with, and when we're presenting the larger ideas, especially if we have a chance to do so on the media, the larger media especially, and that is that I think it will be difficult, especially in the mainstream media, to get these alternative anti-imperial pro-social ideas across, but I don't think we should back off. I think we should try to get through their efforts to prevent that from happening. And I think we need to take it seriously, as it has been in the past. It will continue to be that any efforts to present, for example, the idea that Carl presented was on BP being taken over. Obviously, that's an idea that a lot of people are considering. And in fact, Robert Reich tried to present that on CNN last night and two or three times and got squashed. Because there are these ideas which lead to change in power and authority, which are threatening to the system. I think we have a role to play in promoting them.
I want to suggest that if you sing the song of socialism and those glorious phrases that you can lapse into because you love it, that you have wider appeal, people will become more available to themselves and to you if you're talking about it not as mantra but as that song.
Okay. Well, we've been at it for an hour and a half. We could take more comments or we could summarize.
Thank you for guiding this, Carl. This has been a well-run series.
All right, we'll have to do it again soon. okay. Are we finished?
Thanks very much, Carl. I think Jim said it for all of us. Thank you very much for doing this, Carl.
Okay, have a good weekend, you all.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.
Has left.